All right, welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Ritter.
And we're joined today by Michael Wong. Michael, great to have you here.
I'm thrilled to be here.
You are a planetary scientist, astrobiologist at the University of Washington, and you have a podcast of your own called Strange New Worlds, and I think Andrew's been on before, isn't that right?
That's right.
Yeah, Andrew. It's a Star Trek podcast.
Oh, sorry.
I wasn't sure who you were asking.
Yeah, Andrew was a wonderful guest. We talked about his new book, Beyond the Known, which I gather you've talked about a lot on Spellbound. So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I was reading your paper on the origins of life, Michael. Andrew sent it to me yesterday, and I've been reading it. It's really impressive.
So the paper that you're referencing is a popular science article that I wrote late last year. So I think it came out in like December 2018, called The Making of Life. It's in the Planetary Report, which is the Planetary Society's sort of popular science journal that they put out quarterly. And the Planetary Society, for those listeners who don't know, it's basically a space advocacy group based in Pasadena, California. And the current CEO is Bill Nye, the science guy, and was founded by Carl Sagan and a couple of other colleagues of his.
I think an interesting place to start, I guess the most logical place to start too, is this, you were talking about this common ancestor that all life has called LUCA. I've never heard of this life form. I guess I'm assuming most of our listeners won't have heard of it either. So I'm curious what there is to know about it and what kind of conditions it came to be in.
That's a really great question. So LUCA is an acronym. It stands for the Last Universal Common Ancestor. So all of life as we know it here on Earth is related to one another. And we discover this relation through molecular biology by looking at the DNA and the RNA, the same code, the same letters, the same language that all of life is written in. And we can look at the similarities between the codes in, say, myself and in you, and we can figure out how related we are by how similar those codes are. And if you examine more distant organisms, the codes will be less similar, and you can start to build a tree of life. And this phylogenetic tree of life is the term that scientists use to talk about it, sort of branches as life diversifies and as new species originate. But it all funnels down to what we think is the last universal common ancestor, an ancient life form that probably existed somewhere around 4 billion years ago, from which all of life is descended. And so certain phylogenetic studies can sort of trace the most conserved genes throughout the tree of life, meaning the ones that don't seem to change very much, and try to get back at what this LUCA organism actually did and where it lived and what kinds of abilities it had. And one recent study that came out, I think in 2016, actually discussed the idea that LUCA probably lived at a hydrothermal vent, that it ate hydrogen gas as its food source. It breathed carbon dioxide, it fixed nitrogen, and it was very used to very hot temperatures.
So is this a theoretical species, this LUCA, or is it, or have we found evidence of its existence, or is it just like we just assume that something like this must have existed?
Yeah, it's more of an assumption at this point because it's very hard to actually dig back through the many billions of years of life's evolution. We definitely don't have an example of LUCA here with us on Earth today. We're all descendants of LUCA, as are all the bacteria in our guts, as are the flowers outside my window, as are, you know, the birds in the trees. You know, we're all descendants of LUCA. And we know this because of the unity of biochemistry, the fact that we all use the same molecular toolbox down at the microscopic level. We're all united by that, by our carbon-based chemistry, by the amino acids that build our proteins, by the letters in our DNA and RNA. So it stands to reason that there was some last universal common ancestor. And only recently have we been able to sort of get to know it through tracing back the most conserved genes in life.
It's kind of, it's a pretty personal name for such a elusive creature.
Indeed.
I assume that it's just pure coincidence that it's only one letter different from Lucy, which is the human ancestor.
Yeah, I think that is a coincidence. Although some people are toying around with the idea that Luca may not have been one single organism. So if that's the case, then there may have been multiple Lucas or Lucas?
Or Lucai.
Lucai, I guess, is so if you want the acronym to be Last Universal Common Ancestors or Ancestral Set, then you can actually just make it Lucas. One thing that we know of that happens today between bacterial cells is something called horizontal gene transfer, where genetic material is actually shared amongst a population of bacteria. So they'll just like suck up some DNA that's free-floating or actually create bridges to transfer DNA to other bacterial organisms. And it's quite possible that very early in life's evolution, this horizontal gene transfer was very rampant, such that the definition of what a species is would sort of evaporate or disappear, the boundaries between different species, that is. And so maybe it's not right to just say there was one Luca. Maybe there were, in fact, many Lucas or a Lucas.
Yeah, I assume it's too close. All life on Earth is too close to for it to be convergent evolution, right? Like, or something of that nature. And I guess it's quite possible that there were other genesis of life on Earth and they no longer exist or outcompeted in some way. So there was life different from our own, but it no longer exists. We just don't have any evidence. It's possible. Who knows? But is it possible that maybe life could possibly arise multiple times, but just because evolution converged on the same solution multiple times, maybe there were two or three different origins, but they all kind of looked the same because they were slightly different, but then the differences got washed out by basically differential success by evolution.
Well, okay, so there are a couple of different possibilities here, and one possibility is that there were many different origins of life on Earth, and those separate origins led to different trees of life that use completely different molecular toolboxes. And so there's an idea floating around in the scientific literature called a shadow biosphere, which is a biosphere that exists basically right next to us, but we can't detect it because it uses completely different building blocks to run its biological systems. The other possibility is that there were multiple different emergences of life, but they were compatible with each other on the molecular scale such that they could do horizontal gene transfer. And those differences between them sort of were washed out as genetic transfers basically dominated the evolutionary landscape. And in that idea, which is very intriguing to me, the metaphor for the tree of life becomes even more perfect in my mind. So the normal tree of life is that you have this Luca at the base of the tree, which is sort of extending up and branching off as life diversifies. Exactly. But before Luca, perhaps there were many different lineages of life that all originated in different places that then converged upon what we would associate as the last universal common ancestor, singular, and then diversified into everything that we see today. And so we're sort of blinded by the fact that there was this convergent evolution very early on. We're blinded from all of the different origins that could have contributed to that through these mixing of genes. And so there is, to appropriate a term from astrophysics, a sort of event horizon in origin of life studies, if this is the case, if this theory is the case, which we will never see past Luca to the actual origin of life by looking at phylogenetic studies alone.
Well, it seems like, that's an interesting theory, there could have been other timelines of life before that went into Luca, but I guess it kind of raises the question of, like, I'm assuming that this Luca would be, like, bacteria or something, you know, even smaller than bacteria, so at this point, you're getting into like, you know, kind of like a Grinch-like world where, like, you know, like at the end of the Grinch movie, you realize it was all taking place in a snowflake. You know, all the characters were actually in a snowflake. So it's like, you kind of, gets into this weird heady thing where it's like, well, how complex can life get on such a small scale? Is it realistic that, that there would have been other ancestors before Luca? Or is it more plausible to think that, Luca was just the very first life ever?
Yeah. You raise a really good point. Luca was almost certainly very similar to a bacterial life form. Like I said, there are certain studies that indicate that Luca was consuming hydrogen and CO2 as its fuel sources. This is a common metabolism on Earth today. We know that Luca was chemiosmotic, which means that it basically used a proton gradient to power ATP synthesis. So Luca was actually a very advanced organism, or at least, you know, similar or recognizable compared to organisms that we see today, bacterial organisms that we see today. And so it's actually, you know, it's almost silly to think that Luca is the origin of life, because it seems to be, you know, something that is very far distant from the origin of life itself. And it is the life form that sort of survived that mess of anything that happened between the origin of life and Luca, and that success from which we all sprung forth.
How do you think the origin of life actually is most likely to have taken place? Do you kind of follow the RNA chain, RNA world hypothesis? Is that what you go with?
That's a really great question. So there
can we
are
unpack
many different...
that RNA thing real quick before we answer that? Sure. Just for listeners who may not know?
Absolutely. So one of the leading hypotheses for the origin of life is the RNA world. And the RNA world is basically that the first replicating molecule was a strand of RNA that was built completely abiotically on the early Earth. And most people in the RNA world hypothesis will have this notion of a warm little pond on the surface of a planet. This warm pond contains all sorts of primitive organic molecules. It's energized by ultraviolet light from the young sun and lightning strikes from a turbulent early Earth atmosphere. And this energy deposition builds organic molecules larger and larger until it just so happens that a long RNA molecule will form. And RNA is special because it has the theoretical ability to basically catalyze its own replication. And it's also a very important part in modern day biology. So for those of you who took, you know, biology class in high school a long time ago, basically modern biology works in a very linear direction. People call it the central dogma of biology, which is that all of our information is encoded in DNA. Then that DNA is transcribed or translated into RNA, and then that RNA is then transcribed or translated into proteins. And the proteins are the workhorses of the cell. They do all of life's cellular functions. So it goes from RNA, information passes from DNA to RNA to proteins. And so RNA right now plays this sort of messenger role in biology, but it has the capacity to do information coding and processing like DNA, but it also has the ability to do the activities of proteins, the catalytic powers of proteins. And so people wonder, you know, how could we have originated life in the first place? Maybe we started with an RNA molecule that sort of did both what DNA and proteins do for us now, and then as life evolved, RNA was superseded by the more stable DNA,
specialized
double helix, and then specialized protein forms. And so the RNA world hypothesis is one of the leading candidates for the origin of life. And there are a couple of, I guess, criticisms of the RNA world. One is that the early Earth environment may not have been very conducive to the synthesis of RNA at the surface of the planet. So One of the main ideas for how you synthesize RNA is by energizing a bunch of molecules in this prebiotic soup under an atmosphere full of methane and ammonia. And the chemical formulas for methane and ammonia, respectively, are CH4 and NH3. So essentially, there's a lot of hydrogen in that atmosphere. But it's become more apparent these days from studying geology and comparative planetology that early Earth's atmosphere was probably more oxidizing than that. So the main carbon species in Earth's early atmosphere is probably CO2 rather than methane. And the main nitrogen species in Earth's early atmosphere is probably N2, just nitrogen gas rather than ammonia. And so it becomes very difficult then to create the molecular building blocks of RNA. And even further, should you actually be able to create the monomers of RNA, it's also very difficult to polymerize them. And so people are currently working in the lab trying to understand how what special environments or special scenarios you can concoct on the early Earth to have a soup that is productive towards RNA synthesis. But the origin of life scenario that I wrote about in this Planetary Report article is about the origin of life at hydrothermal vents. And these are deep sea hydrothermal vents that almost certainly existed on the early Earth and that we are pretty sure also exist at the bottom of the oceans in icy moons like Enceladus and perhaps Europa as well. So the origin of life scenario that I wrote about is trying to introduce readers to a scenario that is perhaps not as popularized as the RNA world, but has vast and wide-ranging implications for the possibility of life elsewhere in our solar system.
So you kind of hinted that that the RNA theory of the origin of life is complicated because the Earth's conditions at the time that RNA would have showed up wouldn't necessarily have been conducive to spontaneously generating RNA. But is that to say that those conditions couldn't have existed at some small pocket of the planet and maybe it all spreaded from there or something like that? Is it to say that there was no place on Earth that those conditions could have been met?
Our understanding of early Earth's conditions are still quite poor at the moment. And so you're absolutely right. Near some kind of volcano that happens to be spitting out very hydrogen-rich, or in chemists' terms, very reducing gases, there could have been some productive synthesis. A lot of people also rely on the delivery from meteorites of these either reduced molecules themselves. So it's been discovered through numerous different types of investigations, like the Rosetta spacecraft, looking at what's coming out of the comet 67P's, and it's got a long Russian name, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, I think is the closest can get to it. but anyway, the Rosetta spacecraft, examined the types of things that are on this comet, and it found some primitive organic molecules. We've looked at the types of sugars and amino acids that are found in meteorites. So it could be that you have a lot of these primitive building blocks raining in from space and that they were synthesized actually outside of Earth and then fell down into Earth early on. And one of the most intriguing, very recent hypotheses is that Earth suffered a very large impact early on, after the moon-forming impact, probably something around the size of Moon or maybe Vesta, slammed into Earth and brought a lot of iron, right? So these large asteroids contain a lot of iron in them. And when this iron slammed into Earth, it would have reacted with the water on Earth's surface and essentially stripped away the oxygen from water molecules and released a bunch of hydrogen into the atmosphere. So maybe a giant impact would have created a transient atmosphere that is very productive for RNA synthesis. Mm. So I'm by no means saying that the RNA world is dead. It's still a very good idea. In fact, it's probably still the leading hypothesis for the origin of life on Earth. But the origin of life scenario that I wrote about in the article was a different one, not only for Earth, but that could perhaps also be viable on icy moons with, you know, a place that doesn't have an atmosphere to speak of that could create RNA.
So can you tell us about that? How is that competing with the RNA hypothesis? And, I mean, even if it happens at volcanic vents, subsea volcanic vents, how would life actually come about as a result of that? What kind of life would actually emerge at these underwater vents?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the submarine hydrothermal vent scenario is based on a discussion about how life's metabolic processes emerged. So the RNA world is very focused on how did the first replicating molecule occur, and the hydrothermal vents are actually asking a sort of different question, or taking a sort of different route towards the origin of life, which is how did our metabolisms evolve? So let me talk about how metabolism operates here on Earth in the modern day. But before I even do that, I think I should define a technical term that I'll be using, and that term is disequilibrium. So when I say that a system is in a state of disequilibrium or is far from equilibrium, basically all I'm saying is that there is a system that contains a lot of potential energy that can be transformed into useful work. So for instance, you might think about a person walking a tightrope. That person is in a very precarious situation. He or she has a great deal of gravitational potential energy that, if they fall, could get transformed into kinetic energy. And we can further transform kinetic energy, say, into electric energy, as in the case of hydroelectric power plants. So right in that case, energy that started off as gravitational potential energy transformed into kinetic energy as the water fell, transformed into electric energy as that water spins some kind of turbine. And so this kind of energy
transfer— You're talking about order in the face of entropy.
Order in the face of entropy, exactly. And so biological systems do basically the same type of thing. All of our metabolisms are engaged in energy transformation to maintain order in the face of entropy, as Julian astutely noticed. And so that's the heart of metabolism. And so we must ask ourselves, when we think about the origin of life, what was the original source of disequilibrium or potential energy, and how was that harnessed and transduced into order? And that's what the alkaline hydrothermal vent theory is trying to answer. And so if we look at life today and how metabolism works in life today, the external source of disequilibrium or potential energy is chemical energy. It's the food that we eat and the air that we breathe. And so every living thing must eat and breathe. And the way we liberate energy is basically by transferring electrons from the food that we eat to the oxygen in the air that we breathe. And so chemical energy is actually electrical energy. And what do we do with that electrical energy? Well, to answer that question, we need to dive down into the microscopic level and visit one of our mitochondria, which I'm told I have to say is the powerhouse of the cell.
literally visit, yeah.
Oh, this sounds like a fun visit. Yeah. This sounds like a magic school bus.
Magic school bus, exactly. So let's dive into one of our mitochondria. And what we'll see if we do that is as these electrons are being transferred down what is known as the electron transport chain, little bits of energy that is released during each of these electron transfers is used to pump protons across one of the mitochondria's membranes. And so this creates an imbalance of protons on either side of this membrane. And we have then transduced or transformed electrical energy into a proton gradient. And these protons, you know, imagine you're a proton and you're surrounded by all these other protons that have been pumped right around you. You're repelling each other. You don't want to be next to each other. You want to return to the place that you came from. And the cell allows you to do that. The mitochondria allows you to do that as long as you pass through this very particular tunnel that is called ATP synthase. And when you pass through ATP synthase, you donate some of your energy towards spinning this tunnel's turbine and creating ATP out of ADP and a lone phosphate. And ATP is the energy currency of life. And we call this entire process using the proton motive force. So sort of just like Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, you are constantly using the force. And just to give you a sense of how powerful this proton motive force is, if you think about the proton gradient across the membrane of a mitochondrion, that's about equivalent to 30 million volts per meter in field strength, which is the equivalent of a bolt of lightning. So you are harnessing the field strength of a bolt of lightning in each of your mitochondria, and you are pumping roughly 10 to the power 21 protons per second in your body to power yourself. And that means that in the span of about 2 minutes, you have pumped in a number of protons that is equivalent to the number of stars in the observable universe. So we all rely on this fantastic Rube Goldberg machine of transferring electric energy into proton energy, finally into ATP. And so what does this have to do with the origin of life? Well, one must ask, why do we do it this funny way? And not just us, by the way. Every living thing that we know of does this kind of apparatus to create its ATP. And so why does life on Earth, why is life on Earth unified in this crazy Goldberg scheme to do this? And one potential answer is that we are stuck in our history, that we originated in an environment where these very specific disequilibria or sources of potential energy were naturally occurring. And if we look for a naturally occurring geochemical environment that would give these specific disequilibria, we find them at alkaline hydrothermal vents. And so that is sort of the story of how these vents became one of the most studied locations for the potential origin of life.
You implied earlier that these vents are, I don't think you said it was like controversial or anything necessarily, but you kind of implied it wasn't the most popular theory for the origin of life. But isn't it? I think that's kind of strange because it doesn't seem like anybody who knows anything about evolution, no one denies that the first life form was like underwater creatures. So why wouldn't this be one of the more popular theories?
I'd say that it's gaining traction in popularity, but one of the reasons why it's maybe perhaps not the leading theory is because it's relatively new to the game. These alkaline hydrothermal vents were only discovered in the early 2000s, deep at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. Right, they were very hard to find. They were hypothesized to exist a couple decades before that, but really we had no idea. And only super recently, with the Cassini spacecraft's analysis of the plumes of Enceladus, have we found evidence perhaps of these same types of hydrothermal vents on another world. And so all of a sudden, you know, you can think, oh, wow, if these vents are there on Enceladus, perhaps if this is the way that life started, or if this is the geochemical environment that is conducive to an abiogenesis or an origin of life, maybe there is life swimming around on Enceladus. Otherwise, Enceladus is still a wonderful place to go and study. It would just be a sterile, habitable environment.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
In terms of chemistry, what would that life actually be like? So I'm trying to still understand. I understand we're kind of taking a focus on the energy extraction process rather than the encoding process. So we're looking at like kind of the metabolism rather than the DNA. But what does that tell us about what the actual chemistry of that life would be like?
Well, so the early Earth's ocean will be infused with a lot of CO2, right? Because the early Earth's atmosphere was mostly carbon dioxide, which is spat out by volcanoes, and then some of that carbon dioxide will basically dissolve into the ocean water and cause that ocean to be a little bit acidic. Now, the process that creates these hydrothermal vents is a process known as serpentinization, which sounds almost like a Harry Potter spell that turns people into serpents.
Snake.
But it's really a chemical reaction between seawater and fresh rock that changes the chemical nature of the rock into what we call serpentine. It's sort of a slimy substance, and that's where it derives its name from. But then it also changes the nature of the water. So the water that is pouring out of these vents are not infused with a lot of CO2, but rather infused with a lot of hydrogen, H2. And they're also very alkaline in nature versus the acidic ocean outside of it. So these are the specific sources of disequilibrium. There's a chemical disequilibrium between the H2 in the hydrothermal fluids and the CO2 in the surrounding water. And there is a natural proton motive force because, for our listeners who maybe took chemistry a while ago, that alkalinity and acidity are simply measures of the concentration of protons in water. So you've got this alkaline water mixing with this acidic water. And so if you imagine yourself inside of this hydrothermal vent, the surrounding water is perhaps a millionfold excess in proton concentration. That's a lot of protons that just want to stream into the vent, and that's a lot of free energy that you can tap into. And so you notice that if you've got H2 and CO2, those are out of equilibrium. They want to react with each other. They want to release energy. But if you let them react, they create organic molecules. And you might have some nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur species running around too. And so the end goal, again, is to create life as we know it, just far removed from the energy of sunlight and relying on the natural disequilibrium that geochemistry gives us at the bottom of the ocean.
So it doesn't really say. I mean, what I'm getting is it's unclear what the life would actually be like. We don't know, but it kind of creates the right condition that you could have life. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah. So it creates the right physical and chemical conditions to build organic molecules, to harness free energy so that you can complexify organic molecules. What organic molecules specifically are created is still under investigation. Mm-hmm. People are trying to simulate these types of hydrothermal vents in the lab. And so there's a group at JPL led by Lori Barge. She's basically trying to create miniature hydrothermal vents in the lab. And people are also investigating the types of vents that have been discovered at the bottom of Earth's ocean. So if you go to what is called the Lost City Hydrothermal Field in the middle of the Atlantic, and you dig up some of that sediment, what abiotic molecules do you find there? And it was just last year, I think, that There was a mission to that vent site where they dug up some of this sediment from like 173 meters below the seafloor, and found abiotic tryptophan, which is an amino acid. Yeah, exactly.
It's in the turkey.
But it is becoming more and more apparent that the amino acids, perhaps, of life could have been synthesized in these environments. And ongoing investigations will see what else.
The other thing is mitochondria. So we're talking earlier about the metabolism of life and that all life metabolizes in the same way through these proton pumps. And all of that takes place in the mitochondria, right? And there's this idea in biology that the mitochondria was actually possibly a separate origin of life and it was engulfed by larger cells or something like that. And so originally maybe there was little mitochondria that were separate and then there was maybe bigger cells that I don't know how they metabolized, but maybe that was a second origin of life and they got engulfed or something like that. So I don't know how that relates exactly, but do we know about it? I don't know if that theory is something that you kind of think is reasonable. And if so, what would the larger cells without mitochondria have metabolized? And, you know, how would they have gotten together? And how does that relate to the original life? Could that be a second origin or not?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And so the theory that you're referring to is the endosymbiotic theory for the origin of mitochondria in complex cells, such as the cells that we are made of. And so inside our cells, mitochondria are simply organelles. They are just one little portion of our cell that does all of this energy transduction. And the endosymbiotic theory, which is that mitochondria first originated by being engulfed, as you said, by a larger cell, and then sort of made to do this specific task of energy transduction, is pretty well regarded these days. I'd say most scientists completely are in agreement that this is the origin of mitochondria in complex life. In other words, mitochondrion was probably a lone bacterium that was engulfed by another single-celled life form, probably one from the domain of archaea, according to our best phylogenetic analyses. And that was the origination of complex or eukaryotic cell forms such as ourselves. But all, you know, bacteria and archaea, as far as we can tell, also do this chemiosmotic coupling or use the proton motive force themselves. And so what probably happened at the origin of mitochondria is that an archaean engulfed a bacterium and said, okay, now you bacteria, you just do all of that energy transduction. I'm going to focus my other resources on doing other things like complexifying and having a nucleus and having different proteins that can transport things around the cell in more specific and nuanced ways. And so I think it doesn't necessarily point to a separate origin of life, but the endosymbiotic theory absolutely is pretty well regarded these days, yeah.
So they were probably related, and probably the bacteria also did the same kind of metabolism, but maybe not as well, and gave up that ability once it engulfed the mitochondria?
Yeah. Basically, that's exactly right. And, you know, mitochondria are this really interesting evolutionary point in history. And I'll go off on a little tangent here, which is that it might be, if we were to find alien life that is complex like ourselves, they will also have mitochondria by necessity. And the reason for this is, so think about, so I'm assuming that first complexity requires a large, you know, macroscopic life form. And so then the question becomes, how large can you grow a single-celled life form without having mitochondria? And so remember that all of the ATP is being generated across the cell membrane, okay, by allowing protons to fall through ATP synthase. So the energy production of a single-celled life form will scale as the area, the surface area of that cell. So it scales as the size squared. But the energy demand of a cell will scale as the size cubed, right? Because you need to be able to maintain all of the different functions within the volume of the cell. And so it actually makes very little sense to grow a single-celled life form very large because the energy needed to maintain yourself sort of diminishes. Unless you engulf something that you say, okay, now it's just your job right here. You produce energy, and then you engulf more of those things, and those things multiply. Exactly, specialization. Mm-hmm. And then you can build larger and larger life forms. And so, you know, I would be very intrigued one day when we meet, you know, Vulcans, when Vulcans visit Earth in 2063, I would love to, the first question I would ask them is,
Julian's ready. So,
Do you have mitochondria within your cells?
Yeah. Actually, it's kind of like the specialization of agriculture and how that allowed, or the adoption of agriculture and how that allowed human specialization of technology. It's parallel to that. And you can't have a complex civilization without that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so true. It's interesting how, like, we can't help but specialize and diversify. And that goes back as far as pretty much every origin of life theory that exists.
Efficiency is important. It's what helps you outcompete other life forms that could potentially exist. It's natural selection, baby.
Yeah. This is a question that probably either of you could answer, but I'm still struggling to understand what this RNA theory of the origin of life, what kind of conditions that theory suggests. Is that an underwater theory as well, or is that just like on land somewhere? It could have happened anywhere near a volcano or anything, or where does that take place?
Andrew,
as I understand, water is kind of a natural what do you call it? Solvent. So it's just easier for life to start in water because it doesn't have to be suspended, or it is suspended, doesn't have to worry about gravity, doesn't have to worry about drying out. I mean, life requires water inside its cells, doesn't have to have, you know, like a cell membrane that's hardened to prevent the water from escaping. So it's just way easier for life to start in water. That's the only reason I understand.
Right.
But they both suggest it started in water. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah. I think anything would always... As far as I know, yeah.
Right. That's what I was assuming, but I wasn't sure if that was right.
We are 70% water, right? And so, you know, a lot of people like to say we're carbon-based life forms. Really, what we are is water-based life forms. you know, all of our biochemistry relies on the physical nature of water molecules to dissolve certain ions and to allow proteins to fold in a certain way. And you know, so any origin of life should occur in some kind of aqueous solution. The RNA world hypothesis specifically requires access to light in most cases. So this body of water is usually thought of as a very shallow sort of lake or perhaps tide pool at the edge of the sea on a landmass, whereas the hydrothermal vent scenario is, you know, buried under hundreds of meters of water, if not kilometers of water.
That seems way more likely to me, especially because that's the only place in the solar system we haven't explored is the depths of our own oceans. And also because, you know, we have no idea what's even down there still. Like, there's species we're discovering all the time down there. So it would make sense that a scenario like that would be, you know, it seems like a way better candidate for the origin of life, I think. And, you know, it really doesn't matter what I think, but that's what I think.
Well, you know, I think I should have probably started with this point or prefaced with it. But honestly, nobody understands the origin of life. We have all of these different hypotheses and ideas. But if anybody comes up to you and says, I know exactly how life started from the first molecules to the first living thing in every single step in detail, they're just full of it, you know? We're still investigating all of these things using all of the tools that we have, you know, our theoretical knowledge of physics and chemistry, the laboratory work that sharpens our understanding, and the exploration of novel environments both on Earth and also on other planets. So hopefully within our lifetimes, we'll have a better understanding of the answer. But, you know, we may never truly figure out all the steps to the origin of life. As I said before, there might be sort of an event horizon that we'll just never be able to peer past for the origins of life here on Earth.
Is the lack of ability to understand it more because there's competing theories, all of which make sense, or is it more because we're missing pieces of the puzzle? So is it that we couldn't come up with a plausible theory that covers all the bases, that would be a complete understanding of the origin of life, but may not be because we just can't corroborate that with the actual facts, but it does completely answer the question? Or is it because you think there will always be sort of clues that we will never basically understand even any full plausible scenario? You understand distinction?
Yeah. So right now, I would say that all origin of life theories have some element of magic to them in that they can explain some aspect of life, but not all of them. And so the origin of life theory that, you know, starts at hydrothermal vents, there really isn't an explanation for how RNA came about. The RNA world theory has an explanation for how RNA came about, but not for how metabolism came about, and so forth and so on. So it's that we don't have any full pictures of the origin of life yet.
Is it possible, this is kind of going back to a question I asked earlier, but is it possible that we're looking, and I say we, it sounds like I'm including myself in this, I'm not looking for shit, but is it possible that scientists are looking for like a global theory that could work like worldwide when really they should be looking for any possible scenario that could have existed in some small pocket of Earth? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. Basically, you're saying that most scientists are trying to consider the global average conditions and use that as the starting point, whereas what they should really be doing is looking at very specific locations. And I think
maybe a specialized situation would have created all these, would maybe even unify a lot of these ideas.
Right. And I think the alkaline hydrothermal vent theory is an example of exactly what you're talking about. Those hydrothermal vents are very specific locations on the planet, and they are essentially focusing centers for specific disequilibria or potential energy sources for the onset of metabolism. Those specific disequilibria are not present everywhere on the planet, either now or 4 billion years ago. And so, I think people are moving in that direction. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. As an astrobiologist, what kind of things do you look for when you're contemplating life on other planets? You know, what kind of clues do you look for? What are the leading planets that are of interest for this kind of search?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, for me, I would love to be able to examine the subsurface oceans of Europa and Enceladus for life. The reason for that is because it can maybe tell us whether the alkaline hydrothermal vent theory is plausible or not. You see, the classical RNA world theories would not work on those planets. They don't have atmospheres, and they don't have subaerial land masses exposed to ultraviolet light and lightning. They only have hydrothermal vents. And so if there is life on those worlds and we can determine that it wasn't delivered from some other planetary body through the process known as panspermia, then that would be a big point in favor of the alkaline hydrothermal vent theory. So, I look forward to finding what's in those subsurface oceans and crossing my fingers that Europa Clipper is launched successfully and, has a good tour.
That one's not landing anymore, right? So what measurements is it actually taking of Europa to be able to determine if there's hydrothermal vents that would be able to generate life?
Right, that's a great point. So Europa Clipper is basically going to orbit Jupiter and make multiple flybys of Europa. And it probably alone will not be able to determine if there is life on Europa, but it will hopefully be flying through some plumes, water plumes of Europa, similar to what Cassini did for Enceladus. The plumes of Europa are a bit more tenuous than the ones at Enceladus. So the ones at Enceladus are perennial and constantly spitting free samples out into space. So it'll probably be by chance if the Clipper can fly through one of those plumes. But one thing that Cassini did at Enceladus by flying through Enceladus's plume is analyze the chemical makeup of that plume material. It found hydrogen in large abundance, and hydrogen, again, is a product of serpentinization, that process that creates hydrothermal vents. And it also found small grains of silicates and sodium and things like that, these mineralogical indicators of hydrothermal activity. And so maybe Clipper will do something similar.
So it's going to taste the plumes?
Taste the plumes, if they're there. It's still a debate whether or not they truly exist. But I'm crossing my fingers that they do, and they give us a lot of good information about the potential habitability of Europa's subsurface ocean. Yeah.
Did you want to plug anything, Michael?
Sure. I mean, you can find me on Twitter at MikeWai, that's MIQUAI. And if you're interested in the intersection between science and Star Trek, that's my podcast, Strange New Worlds.
Andrew's been educating me on Star Trek. I'm a late adopter. actually, I still haven't adopted.
Star Trek have you watched? Have you watched any? Have you ever seen a minute of Star Trek?
Yeah, I've seen it. I mean, I'm not totally in the hole. But I have no clue. I couldn't even tell you. I just never had an appreciation.
That like, so I think to an outsider, Star Trek seems a bit strange. Like, especially in the next generation, you got like this Klingon guy with like stuff on his forehead, and you got this like guy who's for some reason
because it's way less
pale.
Cool than Star Wars.
And you're like, what's going on here? You know, like, really, what is this? But
yeah,
once you get into it, it seems like totally normal to me. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, data, yeah. Okay, you know, or like, oh,
well, see,
yeah,
here's the thing.
Of course, he's wearing a visor.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, having had so many conversations with you now about Star Trek, I can now see what it is that's appealing about it. But as an outsider, like growing up and having never really, really watched it, it just always seemed like cheap Star Wars to me. Like, it never really, but now I can appreciate, oh, it's like, okay, these are really well-written scripts that were way ahead of their time, and they make a lot of sense in a historical context and in a scientific context, which is a really tall order for such an old show. And that's why I think it's been so successful, is it's such an old show, but they just have continually hit the nail on the head. So I probably will binge watch it at some point, but I do have three small children that take all my time right now. So it takes a while.
Mm-hmm. You should just watch one episode, and I'll send you the link, but it's so prescient. It's from like 1993 or something, and it's about the universe being a simulation. And then they end up running the universe on a computer for this guy who's a hologram, but becomes sentient. So anyway, that's kind of a spoiler, I guess, but I'll send you this episode.
Can I watch it out of order?
Totally. You can just watch that alone. But it is so incredibly prescient, talking about this stuff that's been coming up in the last few years about, is the universe a simulation? But they were totally covering this stuff like 20 years ago in Star Trek.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, is I think maybe if Star Trek had been created like 15 years later, it would have been a travesty, because they wouldn't have been so ahead of their time. But aesthetically speaking, like, they kind of locked themselves into a look and a feel by starting so early on. They couldn't really like update the look and feel of Star Trek as it got older, because it was like, you know, it's pretty much the same stylistically, it seems, from the outside.
That Discovery is totally different. Like, the new they update everything every series. Now, I guess to some extent, I think that's more the nature of television, though, that Next Gen sort of preserves some of the things from the old series. But Discovery is completely different. Completely.
Oh, is it?
It's very modern, and they do all kinds of, like, rotating cameras for no reason and all this kind of stuff. And actually, I find it annoying, because it doesn't seem like Star Trek. It's too slick.
Oh, wow. You're one of those Trekkies. Wow. That's crazy. No, I got to watch it, because it does. I mean, the more I hear about it, the more I'm like, oh, okay. I understand why people are super into Star Trek, but I just haven't had the time to get into it. I probably will. There's what, like hundreds of episodes? It's like longer than Game of Thrones.
Yeah, well over 700. Yeah. I mean, honestly, probably don't try to binge at all. Just get a list from Andrew of all the good episodes and just watch those.
Is it episodic or serial?
You probably have a ready-made list. Right.
Do I actually don't. No. I don't have a, okay. I don't have a list.
But just watch the simulation one. I think you'll like it. It's not that Star Trek-y, and it really talks about this topic in great detail, which is surprising for 25 years ago. It's amazing.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of good food.
I'm
going to
definitely watch that one. Is the whole show serial or is it episodic?
So, depends on the series. It started out episodic, and there was a big push against it being serial. And Deep Space Nine was the first series to break the mold, and they really struggled, because originally in the first few seasons it was episodic, but there was this kind of goal to make it a little bit more serial, and the network, Paramount, said no. But they started kind of sneaking it in there a little bit, and the serial episodes became the most popular. And then by the end, Deep Space Nine was mostly serial, and it really worked. And Discovery is entirely serial.
So are you guys anti the J.J. Abrams reboots of Star Trek, the movies? Or did you not like
them? They're fine. Yeah. I thought the first one was really good, actually, but the later ones.
I loved the first one.
I don't like the villain, though. The villain is too over the top. Like, villains in movies really bother me, because they're never realistic. They're always just like hell, destruction-bent madmen for no reason. I guess he theoretically had a motivation, but his motivation was revenge. Like, I mean, it's not like a logical thing, right? Like, it's okay, I want to destroy everything, but like, okay, but why? Why can't you just like get over a little bit? And I mean, the smart villains are ones who think they're doing the right thing, right? Who yeah. They're like a Bond villain. They're doing it for, they have an understandable, plausible reasoning behind it. And that's what makes a powerful villain, in my opinion. Just being a maniac for no reason is just so shallow.
Yeah. That's kind of how I feel about the protagonist in the new Joker movie. Having not seen it, but just the understanding the way it was approached. And it's like, it's kind of it seems like the same logic. It's like Joker has just now become this like menace. I mean, I guess it's kind of like a play on, it's kind of a character study on mental health, I guess. But it's also like, I don't know. I feel the same way about so many protagonists now in movies. It's the same way that, it's the same problem we had with villains back in the day, but now it's the protagonists that are unrealistic. Hmm. I don't know.
Interesting. I haven't seen that movie
yet. Yeah, I haven't either. I've been, I'm not sure if I'll wait for it to leave the theater or not. It's actually, it's already grossed over $1 billion in the box office.
Wow. I haven't seen that either, but yeah, crazy.
Crazy. Crazy. Well, guys, this has been really fun. Michael, we'll have to have you back on. You're a wealth of knowledge on this subject. I'm sure there's plenty of other stuff we could talk about. So if it's of interest, we'd love to have you back.
Floaters, sinkers on Jupiter or know, whatever you want.
Those are cool.
Let's do it. This has been a lot of fun. Yeah. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you want to follow Andrew and I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider, and we do these episodes every Monday. Hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.